Thank you for having all of us here today. We're at your apartment here in downtown LA in the Arts District. We're here with Min Phan and Gustavo Arellano.
What's up?
And we're at your place, Winbui. Thank you so much for having us here.
I'm happy to have you. It's an honor.
So we are about to start dinner here, and we thought that we'd get the four of us together just to shoot the breeze. And we're right in the heart of downtown LA, and we can hear the cars go by. We can hear Rosie fixing drinks back there. So it's like we're live right now.
This is live. The cars, the cars are honking, and somebody's getting broken into right now. It's real downtown.
It's not my alarm, so I'm good for now.
This place is nice.
Thank you.
This is a sweet spot.
I was like, what would my teenage boy dreams apartment would be? And I was like, it was just something like this. So I indulged a little. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to start with talking about this idea, like the rising food costs, labor costs that we are experiencing here in LA. How's that all changing the restaurant scene for all three of you?
I think it's certainly making it very challenging to open restaurants, and keeping a restaurant alive it takes everything out of you. I know chefs who run very successful restaurants. They're busy every day, and they tell me if they weren't busy every day, they'd probably have to close. Essentially, they're just taking money from the customers and they're just giving it to their employees. And what is the incentive to open restaurants? I personally am concerned about what the future of dining in Los Angeles is going to look like. And I think possibly it's going to look more like this. The chefs are going to have to run underground. The consequence of that is that how are new chefs going to learn? Because I can only take maybe one stage at a time. I learned from Jeremy Fox, and we had a whole kitchen, and he teaches like a whole class of cooks every year. And, you know, we can continue to have more and more chefs learn. And when we lose great restaurants and great chefs like this, where do we go?
Min, what are your thoughts?
Well, I closed two projects last year. And I imploded. I think it was coming to an implosion. So I was like futuristic thinking. And I'm like, I'm going to implode myself before I'm forced to implode. And, you know, I started thinking why I went down this road. And for me, you know, we've talked about this. I've always been an artist. And it's a really great, food is a really great medium for immigrants. Because if you look at, you know, visual arts and wanting to go to, you know, give your MFA and that art world, which the materials are expensive, the point of entry is expensive, and you just have this thing in you that you're not allowed to be in that world. And then so when I chose food and as my material, I think it's something that's very, and it also serves a more, to me, like a more intentional purpose and closer to my heart. I've been going through that journey. It's like, what does that look like? But I'm leaning into being an artist, but that I have to come up with a whole lexicon on what that looks like. And I think I'm looking at you because I thought about this today. I'm like, oh, you're an artist. So I think there's going to be this bifurcation in food where it's going to be art and then it's going to be fuel, which we've already seen more of that is automation and things that are a lot faster and quicker. And we're going to have to accept that. And I think part of me is I don't fight it. I think it's going to be open a great, the place that I want to be at, because I'm a futurist, right? I want to world build this world where people go back to learning from their families and their friends and ancestral places. Because I think, you know, I think about, and I want to kind of almost stop gatekeeping. You know, it's the pharma table's been gatekept for a really long time. But I, thinking about that, I'm like, you know what, I come from that lineage, you come from that lineage, we come from fine dining, so we keep on praising like people who've taught us, but now I'm like, I brought so much to their kitchen. I brought my medicinal ancestral knowledge. I bring words. I understand these techniques. You know, we've talked about bunjil, you know, things that come from our sweat and blood and our ancestors and our culture. And I think for me, I'm like, maybe, you know, we don't go farm to table. Maybe we go from, you know, transcultural gardens in our heart to table. And that's, what does that look like? And I do think there needs to be respect and love and a value in this, right? And in families. And so I think there is room to create this. But again, our hard job is we have to create, like, you know, like as chefs, we are responsible for so much. You know, if you are operating a business, you're doing a lot of things. And then you have to be intentional about the environment and labor issues and looking, and it's just too much. And so I feel like if we can make some of these spaces, these ecosystems, more manageable, and that's what I think about. You know, in addition to the art and the things I want to do, what is a more manageable and regenerative system for young people? So I'm, Chef, I'm right with you. I think about this, but I'm done looking at the past. I think it's done over. The bifurcation has happened of automation and art. Fine dining is going to keep going. I, you know, if you're doing it right, it's not going to die, right? And I love, I do like pushing food, but I don't think it's going to exist the way it is. So,
Gustavo?
No, I, my wife runs a market and deli in Santana, Alta Baja Market, and I was a food critic for 15 years, so I've always had like an outsider's perspective to everything. And now with Delilah having her place, like I see what people have to deal with, the bills, the labor issues, but also, I mean, I don't know why people run restaurants.
Yeah.
It's the hardest. It's the craziest thing. And then just, you know, a whole other level. I think the, you know, we're talking about ecosystems, restaurant industry, the way we know it, or have seen it, because you're talking about the future, it's the most ruthlessly capitalistic industry I've ever seen. It is like built on pain. It is built on exploitation. It is built on people, family members ripping each other off. Like, it is just absolutely crazy to see that. And we're right now in a moment where people still, I mean, people want to do the high-end stuff. People also just need to survive. Like, here, we're here in downtown LA. We're surrounded by amazing street food. Street food has been a part of Los Angeles for 140 years. We are a world capital of it. And we're at a point now where there's more street food than ever, and people are celebrating it as they should, but people don't realize that. The reason there's more street vendors now, the reason there's more underground restaurants now, is because people need to make a living. Like, they're talking about automation, talking about just all the things that have happened with the pandemic. People are desperate to make some money, any money. And what do they, what do a lot of people know more than anything? How they grew up eating, what people want to eat, and how to do it in a way. And I still don't think the public will ever truly appreciate how much it actually costs to make the food that people are eating. People get mad. Oh, you know, I mean, we could all complain about everything. Like, you know, I still remember, oh, a taco used to be a quarter. You could buy four tacos for a quarter and a buck. I remember we were talking about Lee's sandwiches when it came earlier. So I remember when the first Lee's opened in Little Saigon, and there were, $1.75. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is cheap. And my Vietnamese friends would be like, that used to be 75 cents.
And two, and you buy two and you get one free.
Yeah, there you go. Two, buy two for three. And we've been blessed. We have been blessed. And frankly, we've been spoiled, especially here in Southern California. And I think now it's a time where everyone, we all have to eat. So we all have to figure out, how do you make a more just food system? How do you make a system that you can still eat? Because I worry with all these costs that traditional restaurants do close, because there's something to be said about traditional restaurants where you do have, they become community hubs. Like, I think all the different levels should be, there should be the street tacos, there should be the, you know, the underground restaurants, the dining scenes, like what we're about to have right now. But you also need to have that neighborhood place, the place that's been there, like Suhiro Cafe, been there forever, and now having to relocate. We need to do everything possible to support all levels of it.
But you know, all of this, I feel, comes from regulation.
Oh,
heavy, heavy regulation. I mean, all of us have been in the food business for, you know, 20 years now. And I think you see the growing pain, not growing pains, but the pain of what the Labor Department does, what all of these health, you know, you're sitting in there and you get nervous when the health department comes in. And that shouldn't be the case, right? It's just constantly like that.
My favorite health department story, I was at a Thai restaurant, Santana, that I really liked. And they passed their test, but the health inspector was complaining to the owner that the poster for washing your hands should be yay high, not
that's what
yay
I'm talking
high.
About.
And I'm really? Like,
they're the scariest person to walk in the restaurant.
They are.
The owner, sometime we're walking in the restaurant, and then, you know, we, you know, tense up a little bit, or the chef even, but nothing's because when the health department walks in, everybody's scared.
Yeah,
and then you go run it. You're like, make sure all your buckets are clean. It's just, we have it down because it's and you know, and they, you know, there are good ones, you know, who just like, who knows your place and who knows your quirks, but you know, but I also think that's part of the system we're in. It's like we also, God forbid, someone gets sick, and then we just like, you know, kick their asses. It's just like,
yeah,
so
it's brutal.
Really, it's like, and it's part of, I think, this very, I'm going to say it, I think we're so, we're not reasonable with anything anymore. Everything is so puritanical. Yeah. Like, you have to be this. And, you know, because if these measures get put on a bill, we'd all vote for it to be safe and to go extreme, right? By the way, I am going to push AB 2550 that IHC is bringing to the Capitol on April 9th. It's Eddie Navarrete who is bringing a bill for restaurants to have a lot of those restrictions taken away. It's pretty cool. Like, you know, it hasn't been talked about a lot. It's new, and it's really cool. He actually had me try to, you know, like, I'm like 100% for it, but I can't stand in a public and be like, yeah, because I don't really have a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think it's really cool. But I also think that looking back and being a positive person, I think some of these immigrant roots are to be celebrated because they also, like for Vietnamese, my gentleman friends, one generation, we still labor, but it's, we stand on the shoulders of previous immigrants. But being Vietnamese American, we went, you know, like our parents labored and then they drilled it into us that, hey, if you're going to labor, it's a choice, but you should go study. And it's like, so, but I feel like some of these hard work of immigrant, you know, they can propel or they can change trajectories and you have more choices. For me, like propelling trajectories is just having more choices. That's it. That's the way I define it. People are like, what's like the one thing that you want in change? And I said, I just want people to have choices. Mm. That's it. They want to be liberated from not having to do with something because of having means or, you know, just like having choices. And I think being Vietnamese American, the person not giving us a choice is our parents. That's like the hardest. But I think, you know, as a society, you know, as a community, I think those hard work of early on in Orange County really funneled a lot of our education and our knowledge as a community. And I don't ever want to belittle that, and I don't want to take that system away.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Ever.
You know, just going back to what Chef Nguyen was saying, the innovation because of the education that's happening in the kitchens, that's one aspect of it. The economics is another aspect of it. The regulations are another aspect of it. So that this industry is actually contracting. It's contracting. And we're not getting, like 15 years ago, I think, I'm not saying it was the golden era of anything, but it was certainly a time where you can do business and make money. But that's going away, and it's eroding, and I don't want to be a pessimist, but
it's hard not to be when you're talking about restaurants.
Yeah.
Because I also think it opens opportunities for us to push and get it. Why are we not looking at food like we look at museums who get grants? Why are we not looking at it that way? I am, but I don't know who else is. don't tell everyone because I'm like, because I'm probably going to fail really bad, like I always do with everything first out of the gate. But I think that's the way we should be looking. That's the way, you know, like it's healthcare. These are like human rights. And why are these things not subsidized so you can, so we're equal at a certain level?
As somebody who's going through the grant process right now with the government, and we've already been awarded. we've been already awarded it. It
is,
yeah. It's crazy. It's so much scrutiny to, you know, work in film and get these grants. I can't imagine how you can do it in food.
I do think, again, just that we do need to reimagine our food ways all the way through. Because, yeah, 15 years ago, it was easier to run a restaurant. Yeah. It's easier to do everything. Everything was always going to be easier. But, that, you know, going, I never romanticized the past because everything was always easier, even if it wasn't. Like, in our mind, we think it is. And I'm sorry, but we don't have a time machine to go back in the past. What we could do is see what worked in the past that was good. See what was wrong. This is why I like the idea of reckonings. Like, okay, you are in a bad position. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to make it better for yourself? And how are you going to make the world that you live in better? Because if you don't want to make things better, then you're just a selfish person. Sadly, in the restaurant industry is notorious for the whole, like, you had an entire generation where you lionized assholes.
Yeah.
Horrible, toxic people.
Who can squeeze.
Who can exploit.
Exploit. Just, like, exploit. Those were the badasses.
Yeah, they were the ones that people lionized. Yeah. And we should be past that. And I'm not saying it has to be all everyone friendly and all that. Like, sometimes you have to make people work hard and you tell them something, you have to be curt, but you cannot lionize toxicity. You cannot do that. You cannot lionize exploiting workers. You cannot lionize just all the, you know, wage theft and all these different things. Like, and sadly, you know, and that's why I think where we're at right now, it's like, okay, yeah, things are hard. Let's make them better. How are we going to make them better? And that's where you do need conversations. And more importantly, you need allyship with different sectors of these society or of this ecosystem. I like that word, ecosystem, because ecosystem, there's all these different branches and phylums and blah, blah, blah. And everyone has a role to play in it. And everyone should have their role play their role in it.
Is, you know, forgive me, I don't know much about the street vendor scene, but I always wonder, like, why don't they have that in Little Saigon, right? Because they have it up here.
It's Orange County, for starters. Orange County, sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned that because Orange County is recent, you know, as recently as the 1990s, the health inspectors would go to these stores and see their, you know, Goikwan right there. And, oh, throw it away. But it's like we've been making them and just leaving them, like, right there on the counter forever. Like, we know our culture. We know when something's about to go bad. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, it was because of pioneering politicians. I don't agree with them personally, but I respect them. Like, Van Tran, Tony Lam, they were able to get elected and be able to have wherewithal within the Republican Party in Orange County, because Orange County is still very GOP back then. And they would go to the Board of Supervisors and say, like, hey, you need to change. You need to tell your health inspectors, you need to not make an exception, but listen to us, because we're the ones who know our food the best. You have to listen to us. You cannot take one example and just put it across the board for everyone. It's always
rice. Yeah. They would, like, throw away rice if it isn't cold to a certain temperature, and then you have to reheat each one. And you're like, no, it's just a rice cooker. It's keeping it warm. Yeah. And they're like, but it's in the bad zone. And you're like, well, like, we've been doing this for hundreds of years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were doing this before there was, like, science with rice cookers. Like, we just feel it. And, like, for the health inspector, like, well, you can't just feel something like that. That's, no, you need your temperature and all that.
Yeah.
And, but, again, this is why it's important to have just people who can have those conversations with health inspectors. A lot of times I think we just need to speak the language, and not, we're not talking about, like, actual Vietnamese, Spanish, English, but, like, how does the health code, how does the health inspector talk? How does the banker talk? You're going into street vendors. And so in Orange County, historically, you only had street vendors in Santana, the most Mexican city of them all. And the street vendors there, they were able to get the right to make their taco trucks and all that by suing the city.
Yeah. Is that happening in LA now, where street vendors are allowed to just sell?
The street vendor, in terms of like most legal issues, it goes restaurants the most, then things like this, and then actually street vendors have the easiest.
Really?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what I think restaurants are going to end up, or chefs are going to end up going in. They're going to do things like stands, and they're going to do things like go to street. Because as we've seen, it doesn't matter how hard we get squeezed by the ecosystem and the system, chefs need to cook and artists need
but
to create.
But you have to be young and have, but you have to be young and have energy. I'm not going to go cook, no matter how passionate I am and how much I want to feed everyone.
Those days are over.
Those days are over.
I think the margins are good.
It doesn't matter, right? But it is a young person's game, you know? And then, but I also, I think, you know, I also came of age when you did things, your payment, your capital is passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I came of age when that is the best capital you can have, is you wear that badge of, I'm passionate. I get paid in passion. I want to be recognized for passion. And those days are done.
Yeah, over. That seems like a young...
You know, and it's like, and
you're
it's
still
a
young man.
You're young. See, I'm old, but I
kind of lost that.
But
I'm
still fueled by it, right? But I need a new fix all the time. I'm always looking for the new passion fix, you know, because I feel like it's. I'm gonna be honest. I hate managing people. I love
very few people like it.
I love being auntie and mom, and I love the work, but I think it's just so hard, and that's part of the system breakdown for me. The implosion is I'm one of those old people who I am driven by passion and like the search for knowledge and this like pride in my work. And it's so hard to shake it out of me.
And young people today they just have different work ethics.
And they have those things, but they also see how they don't
want
to be us.
Right, they don't want... So that's like, what I'm saying,
like,
yeah.
You know, they don't... And it's just...
Am I representing the young people?
No, I think I'm early 20s, you know? Yeah. I think people...
And they're great. They're smart. Yeah. Because why should you be colonized? Because you have a lot... It's like it's a part of anti-colonial practices. Mm. So I'm like, yay you. And I look at my parents and they're good... they're good. Like they've been colonized, you know, when they say things like, why can't we all be the quiet, silent type?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they're just so well colonized, you know, and they're just so like, you know, and that's maybe like the Vietnamese why there aren't street vendors. Cause we're like, we're, you know, the way we are, we're like,
but when you go to Vietnam, there's street vendors everywhere.
But the people who come here, like we've been colonized for a really long time, you know, and we, to be honest, to assimilate, we, you know, it's, and we are more afraid of germs and streets. That, like, if you talk to my mom, she's afraid of every single germ on the face of this earth. Like, she would probably go to that street vending site and sanitize their site. So
a good friend of mine who lives in the South Bay, it's a big house by the beach, and he was saying to me recently, my dream is to gather all the ladies that Bang Rawa, the vegetable ladies that you see, all the vendors, and put them in a place like a farmer's market. But I'm like, that's not possible for Little Saigon, is it? I don't know if the mentality.
You have vendors off the, you kind of have I forget the name of the supermarket, but it's on Magnolia and Bolsa.
ABC?
Yeah, the ABC. ABC. Yeah. So you have those women
that's
there.
That's what he was talking about. He's like, you go to
really
ABC.
Cool,
and they're just
get them out of the vans and put them in the tents.
Yeah,
or under
and
like
put them in something more, you know, organized, not formal. Or, but I'm like, the city and state will never allow this sort of entrepreneurial thing to happen on the ground like that. I think we're way past that.
And we might go back to it though. I think it's again, it's regulate. You know, I'm pushing for these because I believe in, you know, transcultural gardens, and we survive on it. Where do you think we got that plant? And, you know,
we won't say what the plant is.
Yeah,
it's a nice plant.
It's
not weed.
It's not weed. But I just think that, system does exist. But I almost think, like, formalizing it, we're going to regulate it again.
Yeah.
And they're going to go away. Yeah. So part of me is like, I don't know if we should. Like, let them be them and, you know, and like, this, like, let's appreciate the heck out of them. You know, like, you know, I just... Yeah, and there's also a system. I mean, my mom, I can ask her. I'm like, oh, Mom, I need, you know, Makrut limes or I need passion fruit. She'll always find, and I'm like, I can't find it right now. She will always find someone. It's like, there's a whole system.
It's a comadre network.
Yeah, and I would never use it at the restaurant, no, ever. Of course not. But, you know.
You know, before we get on to talking about Bouvette, because I do want to talk about your menu, your concept, I do want to talk about something. We are all have been in some form of creative industries, film, food, writing, music, right? Food. AI is changing a lot of this stuff. And I want to get your thoughts on where you think we're all headed with this business of creativity.
I don't really know, in terms of creativity, it's not very good at being, I've been trying to use AI to help me write recipes, so it's really bad.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's okay really. On the dessert end, but on this, I'll give you an example. I was trying to come up with the, on early stages of Bouvette, I was like, maybe I'll do Vietnamese fusion with French. I was like, give me like a few examples of some Vietnamese fusion dishes that you think that would be good. And ChatGPT, very confident, was like, all right, I have a great idea for you.
Confidently.
Get a French baguette, cut it in half, pour pho in it.
Oh, jeez.
Wow. A whole bowl of pho, put the top back on, and enjoy. This is going to be...
Is ChatGPT a douche dude from like...
That is hilarious.
I was like, all right, well, so we're not doing this anymore. So I think it's a long way from taking over creatively.
I think it's the way you prompt it, though. Prompting has a lot to do...
I tried prompting it many different ways. It's okay at dessert, but in terms of savory and understanding how food works, maybe there's not enough data on the internet or something, but...
It seemed
to be having a hard time.
Yeah. Well, that's good for you. That's good for chefs, right?
Yeah, it's great for the career. I mean, it's going to be really...
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Yeah, I think use it as a tool if you know, if it works for you. But I know all the algorithms. No one's been me, because then I'd be more accepted and I wouldn't be so strange and weirdo. So anything that I would like, same. I don't think it's been recorded properly. So I'm like, it can't repeat me. And even if it did, then I'm like, kudos, man. Now there's more people like me. And so I'm like surprisingly not afraid at all, because I know automation's here. Like, deal with it, dudes. Like, we've been, how many of us use DoorDash or, you know, Grubhub? All those things are AI. And I use AI stuff all the time. You know, it's like, you know, things are like automatically showing me something, you know, the time to go do this. It's like all those things, are, you know, it's been around. And I think if we look at it as a tool, then we shouldn't, even writing. I think it's Aaron and I talk, you know, my partner and I who talk about this, you know, he's a college professor. And I'm like, if it helps you, then do it, because I don't think it's going to make you dumber, because you're just going to create more dumb stuff. But I think it actually, if it's helpful, it might make things more equalized.
Mm.
I think it might, you know, make things more, if someone wasn't speaking well or someone didn't understand something, I think it gives them a chance to like make that.
Yeah. You know what happened 3 nights ago? My partner, her mother called me directly and she said, you know, I've been with this church for 8 years and I write all the speeches for the Widows Club and for the mothers of the Catholic Mothers Club. But this one lady stumps me. She doesn't talk much. And I've been asked to write her 80th birthday salutation. And she called me. She said, can you write this for me in Vietnamese? I was like, I was flattered. I was like, thank you for asking me. So I go, tell me in just rough language about this woman and your experience and all these ladies. And she started telling me the story. And I just literally wrote it in English. I took it. I put in ChatGPT. I said, hey, I'm writing a birthday salutation for this woman, blah, blah. Can you write out the speech for me? It gave me four paragraphs. And then once it gave me four paragraphs with the structure, I fixed a little bit. I go, can you write this in Vietnamese? I've had it translated in Vietnamese. I showed my mom. My mom's like, you're such a brilliant writer.
It's really good at writing.
It's so good.
I think we should ask the writer in the room.
I've never tried it.
It was mind-blowing. And then I sent it to her the next day, and she was blown away. She goes, I don't even need to fix anything. My partner's mother, she said, I don't need to fix anything. I'm going to use it as is.
Yeah.
Crazy experience. This just happened.
I have no interest in it. Yeah, we already live in Terminator 2 Judgment Day times. Like, technology rules us. We are, like, it is indispensable to us. And we just keep debuting more and more things. And a lot of columnists have done, like, okay, try to do a, you know, AI version of myself. I've thought of it, but I'm like, you know what? That's a toy to me. Which is cool. I like toys. I play video games, sure. But I'm like, I'd rather just have fun on my own, thinking of these ideas on my own. And like the way I mean, ChatGPT and all that seems to, the way they work is by having people feed stuff to them. Like, okay, here it's like, go for it. Me, I just go out and talk to people. I go see the world around. Like, I think that's the one thing with AI, at least the way we have it now, like it only exists in the digital realm. Right now, like, it can't just walk down the street and see something like, oh, some random thing like that. You have to keep feeding it. And I don't know. I'm not afraid yet. But maybe if I try it, maybe if it can match me, maybe, like, what am I doing? Like, try to find another profession.
But what if it speeds up your work? You ever thought about that?
I already work fast. I don't need to work faster.
It's faster than any robot.
I've never heard this from a writer ever admit to this.
What?
That they're fast.
My bosses make fun of me. Like, oh, you've all seen the meme of Kermit typing and the GIF. That's me. Nonstop. Like, my boss once said, like, if I throw you off an airplane, by the time you land, with a parachute, of course, you could have 5 ideas. I'm like, if you do that, I'll have 10 ideas, and you'll approve 9 of them. So I am a robot. Yeah, I am AI. I am the apocalypse.
We should be studying him.
You know, you're actually the fodder that AI pulls from.
Probably. And even then, though, like, I guess I'm not afraid, me personally, on my own profession, because I know nothing can replicate what I see. And I'm not trying to say, like, oh, I'm a genius or anything like that. But I can connect different things because I study and I talk to people. And I've been doing this long enough to where I'm confident, like, bring it. Like, you know, I also think, as you gain more years of experience and as young people come, I mean, you see in the restaurant industry all the time, like, okay, you were the flavor of the month 10 years ago. Here's this new young gun. What are you going to do about it? At what point do you become the beloved neighborhood standard where you don't have to worry about the people coming for your crown, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the same way in journalism as well. I've done it long enough. It's like, I don't even care about people going after me. I know what I do. I'm confident in what I do. Like, bring it.
Wow. I wanted to ask you three each this idea of, like, when you walk into any level restaurant now, high, mid, low, and you get the experience of the product, the food, the business experience of whatever feeling that you're experiencing with the restaurant, what kinds of things go on in your mind to say, this is going to make it and this is going to fail?
Oh, I wonder what, like, because we journalists, we have a gut feeling. How about you, restaurateurs?
Yeah.
Do you folks have gut feelings?
Overstaff, man. Whenever they're overstaff, I'm
That's what my wife says all the time.
Oh, really?
Why do you need 15 people to give you a menu?
I'm like, who's behind this? Is it going to last a week and they're going to fire everyone? And is it going to last? And I
never thought about that.
And that's always, like, my thing. And then, though, how well-trained the staff are. If they're a little too well-trained and then you look at who's behind you, you're like, they're going to die. Like, it's just like, the thing is, like, you have, because then you know that they spent a lot of time and effort when you know that it's all going to change. Because, like, you open a restaurant so you can change it. End of story. You know, like, you have to, because I think for me as an artist, it's like, it's a dialogue. There's nothing else in the world that's as much of a dialogue than running a restaurant. Because the insurance, it's a business. There's no dialogue there. You don't use the insurance for 20 years. You still get your rates hiked. You don't talk to anyone. You can't. At a restaurant, you can complain. You can tell the person mansplaining, you know, to me how much do you know about something, how you've been to Vietnam, and you know, I'm like, oh, thank you, come on, I appreciate you, give me advice. But that's like the diet, it exists right in this space. And I think that, so my thing is, like, they can't be flexible when they put too much effort in that way. And that's like
a that's a cool little, you know, nuanced thing that I've never thought about.
Because you can change the food and you can change a lot of things. But if you put it, upload it all in front, then unless you're just so rich and you have a restaurant group and you know, and then you're just willing to ride it out. But as a small operator, that's like the, I almost want to come and then just like stop spending money. Just sit with it. Mm. It's like when you buy a new house. If any of you bought a house, it's like sit with it. Don't make all the changes, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's who the chef is. You just, at least I'm coming at it as a reporter. Like you meet someone and you feel magic in them. Like you have talent. Like you are going to succeed. Now, are you going to become a John and Vinny's and have the whole empire? That I cannot tell. But at least right now, right here, I could tell. Like when I, you know, when I first encountered Carlos Salgado from Taco Maria, someone told me about, oh yeah, you know, this guy coming in, going to do Chicano cuisine in Orange County from San Francisco. I'm like, who the fuck is this guy from San Francisco coming into Orange County and says, oh, we're going to do Chicano cuisine? So he had his Twitter account, and I'm like, something like, what the fuck is Chicano cuisine? And his response is, we have issues. And I laughed. I'm like, oh,
wait, you wrote that?
Yeah, no, he said, I wrote to Twitter, I tweeted at him saying, like, what exactly, like, define what Chicano cuisine is. And all he said is, like, we have issues, saying that Chicano cuisine has issues.
Wow, so you knew.
It was so funny. I laughed. I'm like, oh my God, I don't know who this guy is, but this guy is smart. And and his wife became very dear friends of ours. And yeah, I mean, we know what his career happened. So right off the bat, I'm like, this guy knows gets his it. Shit. He knows exactly what it is. I'm trying to think of like restaurants that I knew were going to be failures. That one, again, for me, just coming as a critic, like you could say, oh, the food's crap. It'll last a couple of years or whatnot. That one's a little bit harder for me. I wouldn't know. But the overstaffed thing, that's what my wife says all the time.
Oh, shit.
Like way too many people. Like that's just wasting money, burning it like nothing there.
Yeah. Chef?
I think with new chefy restaurants, you're just finding out whether or not the food's going to connect with the community. And it doesn't matter how good it is. For example, I thought Angler was one of the best restaurants in Los Angeles in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
And it just did not connect with the community. So it didn't matter if the talent was incredible.
That location was so hard, though.
The location was tough. And people, I rarely think the food's over the customer's head. But I think at Angler it was, and it.
We had a friend who worked there. Yeah.
They didn't get it, and I they tried to remodel, and I remember coming in after they revamped everything and poured a bunch of more money in, and I was like, this is not going to happen, because the people don't want to be there. Whereas I think
it's not a dialogue. It has to be a dialogue. Be a dialogue. You know, and sometimes we get tired of the dialogue.
It's a beautiful restaurant.
People want to put their head down and work, and they don't want to, you know, say, hey, come here, and this is why it's good. You know, it's where a lot of these cooks came from, is to be really humble, and humility sometimes gets you nowhere.
Nice guys finish last.
Well, I think that's the job that's changed so much, is you just don't cook. You know, you have to do so many things. You have to be so savvy. Like, you know, when you met Carlos, like so savvy. Like you have to, you know, so it's like I say this, I told Wynn this, I said, I'm not the best cook in the world. I'm probably one of the worst. Hmm. But I know my shit. Like, I know what I love. I know, but now I'm telling her, like, okay, maybe I'm not as bad of a cook as I think I am.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm like, I'm.
If you're bad, we're all fucked.
But I'm like, but I'm out there, right? But like, Aaron, you know, my partner can tell you, like, I am like the worst at home. Like, but every meal I eat, I have to take everything out of the fridge and look at everything. So I look at it like an artist, like it's like my canvas. But you know, but the point is, I think you have to know, if you're going to be a chef and have your own story, you really need to work on that thing every day and honing that thing every day. And I think, and that comes through, I think, when you walk into a restaurant. You're like, does this person believe in what they want to do, or someone gave them a bunch of money?
Damn, that's a perfect transition into Bouvette. What inspired you to start it?
When pandemic hit, I was all the restaurants closed, and I thought, oh, my career's over. Like, what else do I got? The private chef lane was wide open, and I went into it, and it has been very great to me. And so I've been doing that for the last 4 years, almost 5 years now. And I started getting tired of cooking in a home. I had all these ideas I wanted to do. And when you're a private chef, you're making someone else's dream restaurant. You're not really making your food. There's ostensibly you have creative, you know, freedom, but not really. And so I wanted to start cooking my own thing again. And I wanted to cook for the public, and I felt like I had something to say. So I started kind of figuring out what food do I want to make, and what the reflex was to make Vietnamese food. But when I went down onto paper, I just didn't have any ideas, and I realized it's just not what I want to make right now. If I was being really honest with myself, I just don't want to do it right now. It's not like I don't love Vietnamese food. And that's why I turned to ChatGPT. I was just like really desperate. I was like, there's got to be something. I don't have anything. And I was like, you know what? I really love steakhouses. I go to steakhouses certainly more than Vietnamese restaurants. Just it gives me. It's one of those places that before the food arrives, you're already really happy. It's a taco stand on the side of the road does that for me. Dim sum restaurants do that for me. Some places they just like vibrate, and I wanted to do something like that, and I decided to pick a steakhouse. And it also, steakhouses have in America are very European as well. They got things like tartare, pasta. So I just want to crank all those things up from what I learned from my restaurant days, and that's kind of where I live.
Ladies and gentlemen of the audience, do you have any questions? We're going to open up for Q&A.
What are some of your favorite steakhouses in Southern California?
Musso and Frank's is one of my top five restaurants, probably top three restaurants in Los Angeles.
Steakhouses, though, right?
Yes.
No, but he's saying also just top five, period.
Oh, got it. Okay. General,
yeah. It's number one, my favorite restaurant, steakhouse in Los Angeles, and top three restaurants easily.
Do you like about?
You know, when I go in there, well, the service is incredible. They're all career servers, which you don't really see. Rarely see.
Right.
And it's usually in steakhouses that you would see service that that sharp and so committed to their craft. And then the food's, honestly, the food's fine. But everything else is so great. The food is fine, and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's good enough because you're not really there for the food. You're there to hang out.
The vibe.
For the vibe. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible
old school
vibe.
Hollywood.
And I think there's people are kind of living on a spectrum right now of like some people are a little too focused on the food, I think. And then some people are a little too focused on the vibes.
Mm.
I think those are the two places we're ending up in. And I think dining really is about everything. It's about we're going to go out to eat. We're going to hang out. Let's the food be good enough for us to have a good time.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm,
and we're kind of losing that. And I really love about Musso and Frank's. The food, everything works together. It's synergistic. And it's just so much history in there. Like I sit in there and I think, I bet you, like in that booth, somebody closed the deal on Jurassic Park right there. You know, Sinatra used to sit there. Yeah. You know, there's posters of Bourdain and Jonathan Gold, you know, saying how much they love it. It's a great place.
Legends.
Legendary.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to be a fatoy or a disruptor.
You say fatoy?
Uh-huh. I love that term, right? It's like you're just
that's such a cool name. Fatoy.
It's just like a naughty.
I actually don't know that word.
Fatoy means like, you're gonna fuck things up right now. You're being a stinker.
I'm being a stinker.
Let's do it.
I'm gonna be a little stinker.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm gonna be like a little.
I haven't heard that from anybody lately. Fatoy.
I'm like the auntie now, right? What if you got a vegan or a plant-based person in there?
I've had a vegetarian. It works for vegetarians. Vegans, not so much. But they know they're going to a steakhouse. It would, you know. And it's only 8 seats. Like, I pick who comes in. If they're vegan, just suggest that they don't come. Like, I don't... Mm-hmm. It's not like a regular restaurant. Like, I don't need their business.
Frankly. But that's kind of forward thinking, though, because if it's going to be a steakhouse, it should just be 8 people, and you should just do it once a year. You know what I mean? Because it's, for me, I'm, you know, I'm like, from an environmental standpoint, yeah. and meat, you know, I'm like, if you're going to have it, it should be like from Bouvet and just be like the best. You know what I mean? It should be like the best experience. It should have a story, you know, because I'm about the vibes too, but I don't know. Like, I'm this the steakhouse. I get it. I see it and I know it.
I do feel some guilt.
And a good martini is like, yeah, but I don't, part of me thinks those days are numbered though. I don't know. Are they not?
Not if we do these underground things.
Yeah.
Min, would you do one?
An underground
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, like this.
I think I'm the queen of this, you know. But not this. This is my things are, but I you know what? I just that's a good question. I like working alone, but I don't like seeing people when I work alone. So I'm kind of going through a different thing. Is I like, you know, I'm so conceptual and I like working with my hands, but cuz when I feed people, I feel like it's a performance. And sometimes it's performing intimacy is not something that it's intimidating to me. This is very intimate, you know, and I don't cook at home and, you know, I don't cook for my family barely. I do, but it's not what I really would call what I really like doing because no one wants to hear a 5-hour story. You know, at the dinner table. I try, but, you know, but my daughter's like... Mm.
You know what I do want to know is now that you've a little removed from Finnekite and those years of being, you know, number one in L.A., how does it feel now?
I think I'm not going to discount it because I think certain awards and certain, like, there's... brings a currency for your team, and for me it definitely is a privilege and it's an honor, but I've never worked towards it, and then it became a pressure, I think, sustain that for some reason, and I'm like, I'm not about sustaining gatekeeping, so why am I all of a sudden feeling this pressure? And so I really needed to rethink all that, and for me, like, I'm like, because that's not sustaining gatekeeping, is not regenerating new work and energy and doing new things. And for me, like, if I come to my right senses, thank God I did, and then I'm like, I'm just gonna break it all down and do something brand new. And I think that's so with, and I just real, and you kind of helped me through this, is I think I look at things like an artist. For me, it's never the transaction thing sucks. Business sucks, operations sucks. Like, I'm bad at all the things that you're supposed to be good at for a restaurant. But I think for me, I'm because I have honed the material, the, you know, using the materials and understanding that craft, like being a cook, you have to be a really good craftsperson. You have to show up every day and do it a million times.
A what person?
You know, like a cook or,
no, you said past person or what?
What did I say?
A craftsman?
A craftsperson. Yeah, you have to be really good, I think.
Diligent, you know, craftsperson.
Diligent,
right?
And very, and you have to just improve even on the little things every day. And I love that. But I also think that's not the way you run a transactional business. So I'm doing something else. And I had to come to terms with what that is. And I think I don't have a model for it, so I have to come up with a brand new thing again. And I'm probably ahead of my time. I'm going to fail profoundly. But I have to see things in an ecosystem. Because that's the way all my projects are. Finnekite or Porch and Puffs, they're ecosystems. This is an ecosystem. Like, what works for that ecosystem? And I have to find my ecosystem. And, you know, and I'm... And I think the thing that's pushing me the most right now is I'm thinking of being 50 years in the United States. And in my words, the fall of Saigon, because that's what we grew up with. You know, there's many ways, Black April. Or, you know, another spectrum, liberation, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it's a very traumatic time. And I grew up as like an Asian American kid, you know, like, playing with Merlin and, you know, apples and, you know, and it's, but I was a latchkey kid. So I want to revisit. I've never cooked Vietnamese food, right? But I really love, it's where my, that's why I'm going to turn Farm to Table on its head a little bit. I brought that ancestral knowledge to these Farm to Table fine dining restaurants. And I want to, like, now I want to honor that. So I'm going to spend the next 2 years, 18 months, whatever, diving into these store of latchkey Vietnamese food and whatever that may mean, you know, and I, but not in a restaurant format. I don't have the words for it in a project.
Not yet.
Yeah, I don't have the word. It maybe it's a little bit of this, but I have, you know, but I do have a permitted kitchen, so I'm privileged. I do have, you know, I do have a studio that's permitted. So, you know, I'm just.
That being all said, we'll lead into the last question. Is authenticity? Francis Lam asked me about that on the Splint Table. I have my answers. I'd love to hear what you all think of the actual word authenticity.
Oh, I want to hear you guys.
It works for restaurants because it brings them money, because the public wants authenticity. Mm-hmm. We all know authenticity is bullshit. Like, it just doesn't exist. There's no such thing. Like, my mom's, right now as we record this, it's the season of Lent.
Lent, yeah.
And Mexicans, we make capirotada, bread pudding. And so the question then becomes, do you put cheese in capirotada? We do. Other people are like, that's gross. We put carrots. What the hell are you doing putting carrots? You put in an onion. Like, so everyone's capirotada has to be authentic, or no one's capirotada is authentic. But when it comes to restaurants, they put that magic word there and the public wants it. Like when I did my book, Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, I tracked the use of authentic Mexican food being stuck on Mexican restaurants in the United States going back to the 1880s. Uh-huh. Like, and that particular word, the authentic, like authenticity, eat like the Spaniard, like it used to be called Spanish cuisine. Eat like the Spanish Dons, eat like the Aztecs, eat like this. So if a restaurant can make more money going back to, like, you know, trying to just survive and like swim in water instead of just treading, if you want to stick in authentic and that's going to make you more money, God bless you. That doesn't make your food more authentic, but hey, it's all about trying to make that extra penny.
Yeah. That's a great answer.
Beautiful.
Because people want to fight all the time, but it's like, no. I wrote the book on it, damn it. So my answer is real. Yeah.
I don't think people even know what they're asking when they want authenticity. Mm-hmm. I think it's some sort of like idea that they want this like time capsule of the past of a community that they think all eat the same, and it's some sort of aggregate of that. Like, it doesn't exist. Like, house to house, like what you were saying, like my mom's pho is different from my aunt's pho, and you know, which one's the most authentic? There's no such thing. So, you know, when I was doing Bouvette, I was asking myself, like, what is authentic to me? And I think that's the only thing that you can ask. When you make things, you can only ask yourself, what's authentic to me? And that's the only thing that can be true. Because I can't even be authentic to Vietnam. I don't live there. You know, I eat, you know, I'm an accumulation of all these things from living in the United States for so long. Yeah, it's a fool's errand to try to be authentic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Min, for coming today. Gustavo, you drove so far to be here.
Of course, thank you.
And Chef Nguyen, thank you for inviting all of us for
can't wait to cook
first
for
night Bouvette. Yeah, yeah. Thank you all
for
being
hungry.
Here. Awesome, thank you.
We did it.
Thank you so much.
I gotta get bread in the oven.
This is fun. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak.